Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. What is good, everybody? A busy month of March continues here on this show. Ben Heisler with you. We will be joined in just a minute by a guy that's perfect for this time of year. The longtime broadcaster of the Brooklyn Nets. You have also heard his outstanding voice on the NFL on CBS, on March Madness coverage, and many other places in between. Westwood One, NBA on TNT. One of the most versatile and terrific broadcasters that we have working right now. Ian Eagle is our guest for the Awful Announcing Podcast today. Excited to learn more about his story and his start, and he shares some fascinating stories along the way of first getting started and sort of having to showcase some confidence and present a tape that he didn't really have when he first got that Brooklyn Nets job nearly 25 years ago this year. He just celebrated this 25th anniversary with the Nets. They had an Ian Eagle night. We talked a little college basketball as well, asked him about his preparation to do the four games, and he just tells some wonderful stories. So this is a guy that I've been wanting to have on for a long, long time. Figured in the midst of March, this would be a great opportunity to talk to one of the best broadcasters in the country, in Ian Eagle. So before we get to him, I should mention that the Awful Announcing Podcast is presented by our good friends over at BetDSI.com. It's a place that I've been playing since they became a sponsor of the Awful Announcing Podcast, and I've been insanely happy playing and betting with BetDSI.com. They've been paying winners for 20 years. It's one of the top-rated betting review sites, and especially for March Madness, too. You know, you're trying to keep yourself busy at work Thursday and Friday, but at the same time, you know that you have all these different options. You have all these games going on, and for Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, it's maybe not as much as a frenetic pace than it was before, but you know that there's great opportunity, especially if your bracket's busted too. Like if you had Iowa State making a run through Kansas City or Kansas even, although I don't know why you would have picked Kansas this year. That's entirely your fault. But considering all the chocolate still on the board, this is a great opportunity to go ahead and wager during the NCAA tournament. You have Major League Baseball starting up. They have everything from NFL, college football and basketball, NBA, NHL, UFC. There's even political bets, reality TV, esports. There's virtually everything for you on BetDSI.com. They have the fastest payouts in the industry. It's very simple. You pay, you win, and then you can get paid right back. Their mobile site is fantastic as well. That's where I've been placing a lot of those bets as well, especially watching the tournament games, whether you're at a friend's house or at a bar. It's a fantastic place to play. And for you guys that are the Awful Announcing Podcast listeners, I should mention that if you use the promo code AWFUL100, that's AWFUL100, new members at BetDSI.com will get a 100% bonus match. That's more than double your money to start winning today. Like I said, I play there myself. I love it and I highly recommend it to you guys as well. It's at BetDSI.com. Use the promo code AWFUL100 and you can get this limited time 100% bonus offer to go make some extra moolah on the sports that you know and the sports that you love. Remember, it is only a game until you bet it at BetDSI. Remember the promo code AWFUL100. So without further ado, my conversation with the great Ian Eagle. So as we were talking off air, I learned about, and we'll get into plenty of basketball and more of your story and over the next, you know, 25, 30 minutes or so. But I learned that when you are in the New Jersey area, that the next time I am there, not only can I have an opportunity to say hello, but you are now a certified Uber driver, and you did that completely by accident.
That is true. Ben, let me say, first of all, it's great to be on the Awful Announcing Podcast, but it does still feel counterintuitive all these years later, because let's just say my sister, who knows nothing about sports and lives in Florida, older sister, let's say I want to let her know that I had this nice conversation, and I want to tell her that, hey, I was on the Awful Announcing Podcast. You should really check it out. And then her next question would be, it's the what now? Awful Announcing Podcast? Yes, yes. It's the Awful Announcing Podcast, and I was a guest. So I still have to get over that mental hurdle that this is a good thing. This is positive. Yeah, the Uber story for me, I was not an Uber guy. And in fact, I was fighting the urge to join Uber because sometimes I can be a natural contrarian or iconoclast. And my wife and daughter, my son was in college, told me after a long road trip, and I think I had an issue where there was supposed to be a car pickup and it wasn't there and there was some chaos. They said, look, you just have to put this on your phone. Enough is enough. Just get the app. So I relented. I walked into my office, which is upstairs in my house. I start pounding the different screens that come up on my phone to sign up for Uber, and I'm answering question after question. And after a while, I started thinking to myself, it's a lot of questions to just get this app on my phone.
Right.
And finally, I answer the last question, and poof, the screen changes, and it says, congratulations, you are now an Uber driver. So I clearly signed up for the wrong thing. My wife and daughter come running upstairs after I questioned what was happening and instructed me that I did not do any of that right. So, yes, if you are in the New Jersey area and you're in a pinch, I probably can drive you. Just give me 5 stars on the rating. That's all I ask.
Please give Ian 5 stars. Make sure it's a clean, comfortable ride. I hear he offers bottled water and iPhone chargers
Mints.
In the back.
I do have mints. I believe in clean, fresh breath as well for passengers, not just drivers.
If anything, Ian, I would imagine, and listen, you work with some incredible people in production so many years with the Yes Network, 25 years calling Nets games, and we'll get to that in a second. But I would imagine if anything positive can come from this accidental sign-up from Uber is you now have a really good pre-produced segment to really get, you know, the Brooklyn fan base. You know, maybe during the preseason, Ian Eagle is driving people around talking about the Nets. Maybe they don't recognize you. This could be a lot of fun.
This actually sounds like potentially good television. That one we might store away. That could pop up on a Yes Network broadcast 2019-2020. Ben, you'll get full credit as an associate producer.
I appreciate that. Listen, I have to add to my resume whenever I can, Ian, you know that.
It's about diversification. You just try to be as multidimensional as possible, Ben.
That's
do your
true.
Podcast, do your fantasy stuff, and then just plant tremendous large ideas that regional television networks can use as a means in which of promoting their talent.
There you go. By the way, I was talking to you about this off air. Congratulations, 25 years on calling Nets games. It's a really awesome accomplishment. And I actually got a chance, they posted, the Brooklyn Nets did, this really cool video that they put together for you on Ian Eagle Night. And, you know, I'm sorry to have to start things out like this because the video was great and it had all these different iconic calls from you, but I have to know how you haven't beaten Mike Fratello in rock, paper, scissors even once. Like, how does this happen, Ian? The law of averages has to dictate otherwise.
I don't know. He's got some kind of, like, Vulcan mind meld over me. Somehow he convinces me to put the wrong of the three options up every single time. He's undefeated against me. And
it's amazing.
It's actually pretty embarrassing, to be honest with you, because, as you know, Mike's not the sharpest tool, so the fact that I'm getting beat like this consistently by the czar has been one of the more disappointing stretches of my life. That whole night and celebration was completely surreal, and it makes you feel a little bit glassy-eyed because you realize that you've been doing this for so long, and you've been in contact with all these great people, more than anything else, the relationships that have been formed over that 25-year period, that to me stands out. But normally when things like this happen, you're either retiring or you're dead. So
half the time you can't really even enjoy the video.
You can't even enjoy it. So I'm just glad of the three options that this is the one that happened to come my way, that I got to enjoy it in person, and then I get to keep broadcasting the games for X number of years. It really has been a joyride. I know people will think, well, the Nets didn't win a whole lot of games. That's irrelevant in this equation. When you accrue that amount of time at one particular job, trust me, the positives outweigh the negatives by a thousand times.
I know you're a historian of the game. Are you traditionally nostalgic as well?
I don't see myself as nostalgic, but it's funny. I always saw myself as the young guy. I got opportunities as a young broadcaster. So trying to put this into perspective, it's a little tough to now switch your mindset of how others view you. And I get it. When you hit 50 years old or you hit 25 years at a particular job, you begin to realize that for a lot of fans, this is all they know. And I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me, and I'm still to this day in shock when what I would deem an older person comes up to me and says, "Hey, Ian, just want to let you know I've been watching the game since I was a kid." I'm like, "What? How is that possible? If you were a kid, then what was I at that point?" And then, you know, they'll grab their 8-year-old and say, "And you know, little Timmy's now watching the games." And I'm trying to do the math in my head, and I think to myself, are you sure that you've got your math right? Because I'm trying to do the math, and it feels like you're older than me. But I'm not going to say it. I'm going to accept their gratitude and shake their hand and take a selfie and move on with my life.
So who was young Ian Eagle first listening to in the world of sportscasting? Who was somebody that you loved listening to growing up? And did you particularly emulate that broadcaster, at least when you were first starting?
Yeah, I grew up in New York in Queens, Forest Hills, and Marv Albert was doing everything. He was doing the Knicks. He was doing the Rangers. He was doing the local news. And it was pretty apparent that anyone that grew up in that time period that had an interest in becoming a sports broadcaster was going to follow Marv Albert's lead. How he called the game, his inflections, the way he used language, the way he built a call up to a crescendo, his abilities on radio, his abilities then translating to television, his wry sense of humor, all of that made a major impression on me as a young kid. And then, you know, you begin to appreciate others that do it a different way. And you realize that outside of New York, there are other fantastic broadcasters that have their own style. Al Michaels certainly was someone who resonated with me when I was growing up. Remember vividly the 1980 Olympics, and not just his call, but his command, stepping in to later learn that hockey was not a go-to sport for him. This was really the first time he was doing it. And the fact that he could step in and make it feel seamless, that stuck with me. That it's up to you as a broadcaster to immerse yourself in whatever sport you're assigned. And I wanted to be versatile. I wanted to say yes to any opportunities that popped up. Vern Lundquist, same scenario. That Vern was so consistent in how he went about his job, it didn't matter if it was football, basketball, figure skating, track and field, whatever the event, it was still Vern, and the essence of him came through. That really did have an impact on me as a young person during formative years of trying to figure out where I could possibly fit in this business. And I really look back on it now and said to myself, I don't want to say no. I want to say yes. If things pop up, I don't want to be the guy that says, "No, I don't do that." Well, how do I know I don't do that? Unless you give it a shot. So when I started getting phone calls for boxing or track and field or tennis or golf outside the main sports that I thought I would do growing up, I jumped on those opportunities and those chances to use a different part of your brain and exercise a different muscle.
Do you remember a moment, though, when you were trying something that was outside of your comfort zone? And even as much as you prepared and dedicated yourself to trying to feel comfortable, you still just, you're like, I need reps in this sport, or I need reps to just be able to get myself in a flow of something that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, I don't want to mislead that anything I did automatically was fantastic the moment that I put on the headset. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes repetitions, but I really look back on it now and I understood the work ethic that was involved. When I got assigned boxing, this was many years ago, 2000. Dan Dierdorf had been brought over to CBS as the number two football analyst, but at ABC, he also called boxing. So there were going to be some fights that CBS was going to work in conjunction with Showtime, and I got a phone call asking me, it was Amy Sackler at CBS Sports, who's no longer there, but she often was the person that would call on behalf of the executive producer, Terry Ewert. And she called me and said, hey, Ian, you do boxing, right? And that's a leading question. And I said, yeah, I do the hell out of boxing, absolutely. She said, oh, great. We have four fights this summer. Dan Dierdorf is supposed to do them, but he's going to miss two of them, and Terry doesn't want to have a split broadcast crew, so we're going to have you do the play-by-play on them. I said, great, what are the dates? She gives me the dates. I hang up the phone, and I said, oh, crap, I don't do boxing. I've never done boxing. So what happens? I talked to the producer that was assigned, Mike Arnold, who's been at CBS forever, the director of the Super Bowl for CBS. He was producing the event. Deborah Gelman was working as an associate producer on the event. She's now a producer for College Basketball Studio and works on Tops as the producer of that show with Adam Schein and company. So this is 2000. This is 19 years ago. I tell Mike, look, just send me everything you've got. He sends me hours and hours of tapes of Tim Ryan and Gil Clancy calling boxing on CBS. And I'm literally jotting down terms, phrases, putting to memory tone, timing, and I must have watched 30 to 40 hours of boxing, various fights through the years, and I'm building a glossary of terms. I'm trying to put myself in that situation on the mic just from a psychological point of view to prepare for it. And I fly to Vegas. It's the first fight, and it's David Tua against Obed Sullivan. It's two heavyweights. And Terry Ewert, the executive producer, happens to be there in Vegas for a convention. He says, I'm going to take you out to lunch. This is the day of the fight. We sit down at the MGM Grand, and I ordered buffalo chicken wings. He got a Caesar salad. And he says, so what's your background in boxing? And you know, I'm doing this fight. The fight's in 4.5 hours.
Right.
So I'm going to be honest with him. I said, Terry, I've never done a fight. And he looks across the table, like mid-bite of his Caesar salad, and says, really? I said, Terry, look, I want to be truthful here. I said, I've never been to a fight, which is true. I had never been to a boxing match. So now I actually see little beads of sweat forming right on his lip, just above the lip. And he gives me another look, and I said, hey, I want complete transparency here, Terry. I've never been in a fight. Which wasn't completely true. I had, in fifth grade, there was some chatter during the day at 3 o'clock that I was going to fight this guy, James Schneff. I was like, really? I am? How did that happen?
And it's a surprise bookie.
I threw a punch. Yeah, it was a shocker. It was 3 o'clock high and in grade school. So he says, well, what are you doing here? Exactly. I said, no. I'm fully prepared. I'm ready to go. And I put him at ease. We did the fight. The fight, by the way, went like a minute 51. Tua knocks out Obed Sullivan. We ended up doing an undercard bout, which became the crux of what the broadcast was. And we ended up doing three more fights, Evander Holyfield, David Ruiz, Orlin Norris against Andrew Galata, and then Mike Tyson, Lou Savarese, which was the famous fight overseas in Scotland, where afterwards Tyson said he was going to eat Lennox Lewis's children, despite the fact that Lewis did not have any children. So it was a baptism by fire, of course, but I look back on it now and I felt like I did everything in my power to prepare, to familiarize myself with what I was walking into. And of course, when you put the headset on for the first time, there's that moment of trepidation, but you have to have confidence in the performance aspect of it, in addition to just the preparation aspect. And I think when those two worlds collide in that manner, that's when you feel that you can hit a comfort zone of being on the air.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the confidence component to it, because I think it goes sort of hand in hand. And in learning a little bit more about you and about your story and about your start, it was that same confidence angle that helped you land that Nets job. I think the story goes that you were reading, was it Phil Mushnick in the New York Post? You see
yep.
that what Howard David isn't coming back, and you prepare yourself to go and meet with the Nets director of broadcasting and say, this is a great opportunity to go out and seize it. Am I getting that story correct?
Yeah, you are, and it happened very quickly. Phil's New York Post column, which has been legendary here in the New York area as a media critic, and not just media, but sports in general, had a note that Howard David, the longtime voice of the Nets, would not be returning for the 1994-95 season. It was an idle note. It wasn't a lead item. It was in a larger column somewhere down towards the bottom. And I remember vividly, I was at WFAN Radio, where I started in one of the back edit bays where you could get a little privacy. And it hit me in that moment that this is a job that I should look into. It just made so much sense to me. I don't know if it made any sense to the Nets. So I asked around. Russ Salzberg was working at WFAN at that point and had a connection with the state of New Jersey, because WWOR was located there, and he often was at Net practices and dealt with the Nets because that was quote-unquote New Jersey station. So I asked his opinion, and Don Sperling, who worked at NBA Entertainment and now runs the Giants broadcast entities, was someone that I trusted, and I thought I could get a gauge of who I should contact. Ultimately, they both told me to reach out to Amy Shear, the director of broadcasting, and I called her just out of left field. She picked up the phone. I explained who I was. She said, oh, yeah, I know your work. She had listened to me on WFAN doing talk shows, doing updates. I was hosting the Jets pre- and post-game show. She said, well, if you can drive over here today and drop off a tape, we're very late in the process, but I will assure you that somebody will at least listen to it. I said, great. I'm going to go right after work. I'll be there. So I drive to Jersey. I know nothing about the state of New Jersey. I'm from Forest Hills, Queens. I was living in Manhattan at the time. I avoided Jersey often like the plague, because New Yorkers have this perception. All you know is if you land in Newark that there are oil refineries around you, and you have no idea that there's this beautiful state behind it. I drive out there. I get lost. I don't understand the jug handle. It makes no sense to me that you have to get right to get left. I blow the exit. I loop back around. I blow the exit again. I eventually get to the Net offices, and I drop off a tape to Amy Shear. And that tape consists of me in college calling a Syracuse-Seton Hall game at the Meadowlands. Ollie Taylor hit a game winner. P.J. Carlissimo, the head coach, Jim Boeheim for Syracuse. It was a really good Syracuse team with Derek Coleman and Billy Owens and Stevie Thompson and Dave Johnson, former NBA player with the Portland Trail Blazers.
Yeah.
And they lost at the buzzer. And I thought, okay, there's some symmetry here. It happened at the Meadowlands where the Nets play. It was a buzzer beater. It shows my abilities. And I hand her the tape. She comes downstairs to meet me, so I get to meet her, look her in the eye, shake her hand, try to make an impression, even if it's over a 2 or 3 minute period. And that was that. I walked out of there. I attempted to get back to Manhattan. And the next day I got a phone call saying, hey, we like what we heard. We want more. She said, do you have more? I said, yeah, oh yeah, I have more. Sure, sure. She said, but not college, not from college, more recent. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, I've got more. I didn't have more. There's no more. That was it. That was the only play-by-play I had done. There were no play-by-play opportunities when I got out of Syracuse in the New York area. I was working at FAN as a producer, worked my way up to an update person and a talk show host, and as mentioned, pre and post with the Jets. So I reached out to some friends at NBA Entertainment, which was in Secaucus, New Jersey. I asked them, could I go into a small studio and call a game off of a TV monitor, and can we put crowd noise blended in? And it was Rich Kopelnick and Steve Herbst. They both said, yeah, I think we could do that. Come in. So I go back to New Jersey. I do the whole thing. I call a half of a Net-Nick playoff game from that previous season. And I picked one where the Nets were on a good run. So it was a positive feeling. And I called it by myself in a small little studio. I took that tape over to the Nets and again met up with Amy Shearer. She listened with her boss, Jim Lamparello. They called me the next day and said, our president would like to meet you. And it was John Spoelstra, Eric Spoelstra's dad. And then the rest is history. I ended up getting the job. And a lot of it was based on just having the confidence that I could deliver in those moments, just in the interview process more than anything else, and convince them that I was the right person for the gig. And obviously I've been there now spanning 25 years.
I think the great part about that story too, Ian, is that even in that very moment when maybe you didn't have something to give them, it kind of reminds me of that phrase that you hear often in improv, which is supposed to be yes and. Like there's no turning away from the setup for somebody when they set you up for something. It's yes and you keep it going. It kind of feels like you had that sort of vision for whenever you were interviewing, whenever something came in your way. It wasn't, no, I don't have this at this very moment. It's yes and let me go make a tape.
Yeah, my parents were entertainers. My father was a stand-up comedian, a musician, an actor. My mother was a singer and an actress. So I was around that my entire life. And I think it was instilled in me that if the moment comes, you have to take advantage of the moment. And I was also told by both of them at a very young age that I could do whatever it was that I wanted to do. I was not going to be the center on the Los Angeles Lakers. I knew that much. There were going to be physical limitations, but I also knew that if it was something where my personality would be part of the equation of getting a job and meeting people and interacting with people, that I felt confident that I could look someone in the eye and convince them that I was the right person for the position. And obviously the performance part comes into play as well. If you give them a poor tape, then you're not getting the interview. There are different stages along the way. I felt confident that I could grow into the role. And that was something that I articulated to John Spoelstra in that meeting, that I'm not going to be the best NBA broadcaster on day one, but I plan on becoming one of the best NBA broadcasters over my tenure. So I do think confidence without being overly cocky, some of it was naivete also. I was very young, and I just believed these things. I look back now and think to myself, was I doing this with a false sense of confidence and a blind confidence about myself? But it did work at the time. This is now many years later. But the two worlds have to marry together. You can have that confidence, but you better be able to back it up in the moment.
By the way, I too share that sentiment of not being able to be a center. This, for me, it was the Chicago Bulls. They were doing quite well in the 90s. The good news is that, you know, I'm a 6'2" Jewish guy, so at least I get to play the five and Sundays at the J, but it wasn't going to translate at the NBA level. So I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, in context, you're a big man. I mean, that, just think of it that way.
Yes,
you are,
in a very
you are
small
the big
context.
Man on your squad.
Which just goes everything to show you that we're not in line for a successful season coming up in spring J-ball if the 6'2" guy is playing the big. Can we fast forward a lot of years later? We're talking about the beginning stages, and 25 years later, voice of the Nets, NFL on CBS, college basketball, Westwood One, and now you have a family and two children. And I'm wondering, in the midst of this 25-year journey, longer if you start talking about your time in 1990 starting at WFAN. In the midst of all of this, did you ever think, how am I going to balance all of this and not have to give up something that I love?
Yeah, there have been those moments along the way. I have a really understanding family. I think that played a key role in maintaining these jobs. My wife, Elisa, who I met in college, that part of it, she is not under some false impression that I wanted to be a dentist and then I just changed at the last moment. She's known exactly what I've wanted to do and has been on board because she does have that experience from literally freshman year into sophomore year of me making it very clear what my dreams and goals and objectives were. That doesn't mean that it's just smooth sailing just because she knew I wanted to be a sports broadcaster and travel the country, that automatically, no problem, just go do what you got to do. It does require a lot of understanding and balance. And then two kids that realized early on in life that it's better to have a dad who is happy with what he's doing and maybe not around for every event and every dinner, than to have a dad that's not happy with his job and is around for everything, but is consistently negative and is talking about all of the things that he should be doing in life and isn't doing. So when you look at it on that plane, it seems pretty obvious that the previous setup is a much better one for a family dynamic. And that's, fortunately, what we've had. My son, Noah, who is at Syracuse graduating, has made the decision that he wants to do this. And that means a lot to me, that this life and lifestyle did not turn him off, that he still sees it as a positive and a way that you can build a life. And my daughter, Erin, has no interest in this whatsoever. And that means a lot to me, too, because she's made her own choices and she wants to be involved in fashion and social media and correcting her father for joining Uber, things of that nature. So I think it takes everybody to pitch in a little bit, and it really did require someone very strong in my household, and my wife is fortunately a rock star in that department.
I know you don't have all day, so I want to switch over, but I could talk to you about this for hours because it's been fascinating. So if we could switch over to the college side, obviously – we just wrapped up the round of 64 and 32 last weekend for the NCAA tournament. You're going to be in Kansas City for the games on Friday and Sunday. I'd love to know what your preparation is like for these four-game all-day slates. And how do you tell your body and your brain to basically say, hey, you know that one game that I do most nights? I need you to be good to do three more of that today. How do you do that?
Yeah, Jim Spanarkle writes down on a piece of paper, he's been doing this for years, in large letters, energy, and he puts it right in front of him to remind him that in game four, you have an audience that does not care about game one, two, or three. They're geared up for your fourth game. It might be at 10 o'clock at night, but whatever's happened earlier is irrelevant to that audience. So you have to look at these as four separate entities. And that's part of compartmentalizing the information. You'll feel overwhelmed if you think of it as eight teams. And I've done the first four as well. So now you're looking at potentially 12 teams that you have to learn in a very short period of time. The basic process that I've tried to use in attacking this is separating it into four different games. And when you're preparing for a game, you have a certain routine you go through, as opposed to saying, well, I'm just going to prepare for eight teams, and then hopefully the information will stick when the two teams that are next up come on the floor. You can't look at it that way. You have to look at it as matchups. It is daunting. It's by far the most challenging thing that I do over the course of the year. I'm not going to over-dramatize it. We realize in context what it is. You're preparing for this festival of college basketball. The question is, how familiar are you with the teams? And you really have to commit to the idea of learning as much as possible so that your audience, who has been living and breathing with these teams all year feels as if you've done the work necessary to familiarize yourself with the important storylines and narratives. And then the other part, which is the very simple part of play-by-play, is identification. You know, when you're on television, you do have a little bit of a leeway because fans can see it, or you don't have to nail it with every pass and every dribble for every player that touches the ball. On radio, it's a little different, and the identification part becomes the real driving force behind your preparation. Television, I think you're often looking at other avenues so that you familiarize yourself with the team the best you can, and away you go. Once the games start, then I think your instincts kick in and you call a game. For me, energy is not usually an issue. I feel like I've got a natural energy in calling the games. I've tried to equip myself in that way. I want to be there. I want to make sure that it comes across that way to the audience, that this is important to me. And my priorities are whatever else is happening in my life over that 72-hour period takes a back seat to the four games that I'm calling in that first round of the tournament.
Yeah, speaking of energy, I actually asked this to Clark Kellogg a few weeks ago on this very podcast. You guys have so many just insanely talented coworkers over at CBS, over at Turner, calling games for March Madness alongside you. Is there a voice amongst your coworkers, or really anybody in general, that just gets you amped up or fired up when you're watching a game, maybe gets your heart start to beat a little bit faster when you're settling in to watch a March Madness game?
You know, I think Bill Raftery has made the kind of impact in this industry that you just don't see very often because of his natural joy that comes through the microphone. You know that this guy, if he wasn't sitting there watching the game with a headset on, would be somewhere else watching the game, reacting in the same way, next to you on a couch or on a bar stool, probably more on a bar stool, but maybe even on a couch. You never know with Bill. He's a surprising man. I do think there's a reason why fans have really connected with him. All the guys that are doing the tournament, truly, at CBS and Turner, every last one of them is excellent at their job. To get to this level, the play-by-play guys between Jim Nantz and Brian Anderson and Kevin Harlan and Andrew Catalan and Spiro Dides and Carter Blackburn, Brad Nessler, who is a gifted play-by-play man as part of the 8-man rotation in college basketball, they're all great at their job, truly. And I can go through every analyst. They bring something a little different to the table. I've been fortunate to work with a bunch of them and the sideline reporters. Our production team is Craig Silver and Suzanne Smith. These two have been at CBS Sports literally for a lifetime, more than 30 years for both of them. And they're assigned to this tournament. And there's a trust level that grows with having that much experience in working this event, and it truly is a collaborative effort. Kamani Morales and George Wishart are our associate directors, and Rachel Wagner and Alex Wolf are BAs. It takes everyone to do their job well in order to put this on the air and feel really good about the product, game in and game out. And that's just a fraction of the names and people that have the kind of impact in excelling at their jobs.
All right, before I let you go, Ian, and you've been super gracious with your time, and it's been really a joy to talk to you today, so I appreciate it. I know you're on record of saying you love all your broadcast partners equally, but I mean, you and Bill Raftery have a very special relationship. He was your first partner in television, and I'm wondering, amongst the several hundreds of Bill Raftery stories that you have ingrained into your memory, is there one or two that maybe stand out the most?
There are many, and many of them have been told. There are many that I truly cannot tell because they're personal and They have a lot to do with our relationship over time. He's not just a broadcast partner. He's truly one of my best friends. He's one of the people that I look up to and I consider family in many ways. And our families are family. So once you get to that level, and I've been really fortunate to have that with a number of broadcast partners, I think the key for me from a play-by-play man perspective, early on I learned that I can be malleable and I can adjust. I don't ask my analysts to adjust all that much. I ask them to be them. And then I try to figure out what parts of their personality I can help bring out on the air. Everybody that does that job has a point of view because they've played the game or coached the game. And now it's your job to make sure that their best self is being shown on television. The key for me with Bill, I just learned early on that there should be some fun. There should be some levity. There should be some human moments that you can relate to the announcers. I'm not saying that they become the show, because really that is not Bill's intent at all. He's there hoping to enhance because his sheer joy of the event is coming out onto the airwaves. But with Bill, it's like traveling with this incredible public figure that everybody is galvanized by. You walk into an arena with him. You walk into an airport with him. You walk into a restaurant with him, and people just gravitate towards him. He's not running for office, yet he will shake every hand. He will kiss every baby, or he will kiss every hand or shake every baby. You don't know with him. It could be either. Truly, he just got that it factor as a human being, and then to see the success that he's earned on television has just been this added bonus for anyone that knows him. And you know, when I started with him, I didn't really understand it, because you'd end up at a dinner with 14 people, and I'd ask around. This was early on in our partnership, and I'd say, well, how do you know Bill? He'd say, oh, I caddied for him 8 years ago. Okay, and I asked another guy, well, how do you know Bill? He goes, oh, I met him at a bagel shop in Florida, and we hit it off. I said, oh, okay. I asked another guy, how do you know Bill? He goes, oh, I'm Bill's accountant. Oh, all right, that seems somewhat. It was just a wide array of people that he's collected through the years, and he ingratiates himself to all of them. Everybody feels comfortable. That's a gift that he has, and because I saw it early, I realized, well, that's the way you're supposed to live life. That's how you're supposed to treat people. And it really did plant a seed in me, and not just broadcasting, but in life in general.
Ian, this was a lot of fun. I really do appreciate your time. I'm excited to hear your call from Kansas City this weekend for the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight. You can catch Ian, Jim Spanarkle, Jamie Erdahl on CBS and Turner's coverage of the NCAA tournament on Friday and Sunday. They'll, of course, have games all throughout Thursday through Sunday as well. But thank you for the time. You've been super generous with it, and certainly look forward to doing this again soon. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, bud. Enjoy it, man. Enjoy the game. Should be fun.